It is 8:30, and we have with us once again Joff Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, co-editors at Eat the Steak. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Good morning.
And, well, what a week it's been. For some people, they couldn't, keep their TVs on enough, and other people were flipping them off.
Couldn't keep them off enough, yeah.
Yeah, that was me.
It was truly remarkable, and I don't want to spend much time on it because, the goal of a Ronald Reagan free zone is an excellent goal. But the remarkable thing about the coverage this week, and they talked about it a little bit on Counterspin, was just how little of Ronald Reagan's true legacy was covered in the media. All the column inches and all the airtime that was given to Reagan, and virtually nothing about Iran-Contra, virtually nothing about his ignoring the AIDS crisis, which cost literally thousands upon thousands of lives with the delay in research, nothing about the pollution, nothing about the death squads in El Salvador.
Nothing about his labor record. Nothing about the SNL scandal.
Yeah, it goes on and on and on. Trees cause pollution. I mean, nothing about his record as governor of California that
is
mantling
food.
As a vegetable.
It's not even really a food.
Yeah, it just goes on. Nothing about his dismantling the higher education system in California as governor. Nothing about his record as a snitch, basically, while president of the Screen Actors Guild with the Hawk hearings. I mean, it just goes on and on and on. He spent his adult life, we talked about David Dellinger last week on this program, and, two contemporaries, you could scarcely look for more of a contrast between a man who lived his life with love and speaking truth to power and a man who was in power and reading lines for an audience. So it was a good week to be seeking out alternative media and alternative perspectives.
Mm. All right, well, let's move along. Dramatic.
Such is what you'll get for the next 30 minutes here.
Surprising news in Idaho, court case there, a student.
Yes, Sami Omar al-Hussein, the Idaho graduate student that was arrested in February of 2003, so he's been in jail for over a year, he had a 7-week-long trial, and he was acquitted of nearly all the charges filed against him, certainly acquitted of all the terrorism charges. He has a few of the visa violation charges the jury was deadlocked on. But essentially, here's a guy who had volunteered his time. He was a graduate student at the University of Idaho. He's a Saudi national. He had volunteered his time to help set up the website for a group in the United States that promotes the Islamic religion, promotes Islam. And he had helped them post a whole bunch of different documents on their website, just a huge mass of information on their website, mostly about Islam. Now, among all that information were four short little pieces written by radical clerics that discussed the ongoing struggle in Chechnya and in Afghanistan. This was before 9/11. That discussed that struggle, and those four little documents contained discussions of terrorist attacks, including bombings, etc. Now, he was not responsible for writing them. He says he did not even read them when they were posted, and they were a part of a lot of different information that was put up on the website. Now, this trial itself has been a test of the Patriot Act and the Patriot Act's ability to scoop up and to convict people for simply doing secondary things that might have aided terrorists at some point or another. And this was really a free speech issue here. This guy, all he did was help him set up a website and post material. Some of that material was suspect, but the defense was so...
A very small percentage of that material.
Yeah, a very, very small amount of that material. And the defense was so confident they would win their case, that the government had no case to convict this guy, that all they did was they called one witness. And the one witness that they called was a former CIA expert, anti-terrorism expert, who laughed and said, really, you can't prosecute somebody for exercising their free speech rights, and the government has to be dreaming if they think people go and join the jihad by what they read on the internet.
Yeah, and unfortunately here, the government really did win its case because they didn't need a conviction in order to chill free speech, and that's really what this was about. This guy spent nearly a year and a half in jail, you know, after being arrested in a SWAT team-like situation. This is just an ordinary graduate student at the University of Idaho in Moscow.
The FBI terrified the whole Muslim community town.
And not just the Muslim community, but a substantial portion of the university community as well. And, you know, went through all of this, they had to go through the entire trial. This is a chilling thing for any foreign national in the United States who reads about this. The guy being prosecuted because of volunteer work. This was one of his visa violations that he did not for pay volunteer work for an organization. I mean, it goes on and on.
His visa was listed as a student visa, FBI was trying to get him because he had done some volunteer unpaid work that was not listed on his visa. That was the visa violation. That kind of chilling aspect of this case is one of those things that is enormously oppressive for people who are coming to live in this country, to work here for a while, and then eventually want to return home. It's enormously oppressive.
Yeah, including here in Seattle, people in that situation. And when you talk about returning home, you know, if you are a Saudi national, as this guy is, now you're going to be returning home. You've got a cloud over your head. You were accused by the United States government of terrorist activity, and you're going back home to a country where they put terrorists in dungeons, or they shoot them.
Or they behead them
after they torture them. And, you know, you're talking about the possibility of a death sentence looking at some of these guys if they feel like they're going to be singled out by the United States government. It's a very, very chilling situation, even if the government doesn't win its case. And the case here was virtually non-existent, as Maria said.
Well, speaking of the Patriot Act and the poster boy for it, John Ashcroft this week came before the Senate?
Yeah, he came before the Senate Judiciary Committee and tried to play God, or at least King. It was on Tuesday, and Molly Ivins has a great column about this. You know, Mark Tuesday is the day the Constitution died. It really was remarkable. The Senate Judiciary Committee was looking for the memos to the White House, in the White House, to the President about the use of torture at Abu Ghraib.
Memos drafted by White House lawyers,
drafted by Pentagon lawyers, basically saying that the Geneva Convention did not apply to the President of the United States, that United States law did not apply to the President of the United States. I mean, remarkable memos. If these memos ever see the light of day, they should be a scandal in and of themselves. And John Ashcroft said, no, I don't have to answer your subpoena. Why don't I have to answer your subpoena? Because I don't want to. Not invoking executive privilege, not invoking any other particular doctrine of law, just because he decided he didn't want to. It really is remarkable. I mean, there's a priceless quote from one of the Democratic senators in the committee who they're all sitting there slack-jawed, who is saying, you know, sir, Attorney General, with all due respect, your personal opinion does not constitute law. And, I mean, this really is what it boils down to under this administration, where you used to talk under the Nixon administration about imperial government. This is what it looks like. This is, you know, l'estat c'est moi. I am the state.
I thought John Ashcroft had a direct line to God, though.
Well, he and President Bush do both, but
you almost said Ronald Reagan.
Yeah, I know, I did. It's been that kind of week. What can I say?
Of course, Ronald Reagan thought he had a direct line to God too.
Well, he's got a direct line to somebody this week, but
we're not sure who.
No, the jury will still have to stay out on that one, but. It really was, again, one of these situations where if you had a citizenry that was paying attention to this kind of stuff, I mean, this is the sort of thing that people ought to be out in the streets about, that we have a government, a pseudo-elected government in the United States that is saying the law does not apply to us.
Right. And this is the same week when George Bush was answering reporters' questions of, sir, did you see those memos? Sir, did you approve torture at U.S. military facilities? And his answer was not a direct no. His answer was not a direct no. It was, I can't remember seeing those memos. which is right out of Ronald Reagan's playbook.
I do not recall.
I do not recall. And his answer to the "Did you approve torture?" was not a direct no either. It was, "I only said that we should do what's within the law." That's what he said, which is clearly covering his butt. He's clearly covering his butt legally.
Yeah, he's clearly trying to you know, not tell a direct lie, but give a misimpression.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, moving across the ocean, Tony Blair, the citizens there aren't...
Well, I wanted to talk about a little more about Abu Ghraib while we were on too.
Yeah, why don't we
talk about that? Yeah, where... you know, it's been sort of a fascinating dynamic, particularly in this administration, that they've learned to put out bad news on Friday, because the way the news cycle works is that Saturday is the day of the least television viewership and the lowest newspaper readership of the week. You know, a lot of reporters have gone home for the weekend because they work on Sunday for Monday editions. They've learned to bury bad news on Friday. And with Reagan's funeral yesterday, you know, what could be a possibly better day to bury bad news? Well, there was a whopper yesterday. It turns out that there were no less than five different various low-level army officials who complained about the torture at Abu Ghraib last fall, while the torture was happening, in October and November and December, not in January when the whistleblower, finally got launched and an anonymous complaint finally launched an internal investigation by the Army. But we're talking about a number of months previously. Those complaints went up the chain of command and nothing happened. Absolutely nothing happened, even though you had multiple complaints. Not
except
just
that those soldiers were reassigned.
The soldiers were reassigned. That was it. Which, you know, the problem here wasn't the soldiers' squeamish stomachs. It was the problem of the Geneva Convention again. But you had here not just outside organizations like the Internal Red Cross complaining, but people within the Army, people who were witness to the torture, witness to the abuses going on inside the prison system, being reassigned rather than investigations being launched into what was clearly outside the law.
Yeah. Well, I think that's just going to continue to expand.
So, yeah, I think, you know, everything we're hearing about this suggests that this was not, you know, a few rogue soldiers gone bad, that it was a systemic policy, and that policy was approved at the highest levels of the Bush administration, up to and including the president.
Mm-hmm. I would agree with that.
All right. Well, anything else on that?
No, let's move on.
I think that's enough.
All right. Tony Blair's popularity seems to be dropping.
Yeah, they had local elections in the UK this week, and Tony Blair had expected it to be a tight race with the Conservatives. Well, what happened was his party came in third place with a very, very dismal 26%. The Conservatives won 38%, and the Liberal Democrats, who are usually third place in Britain, they took 30%, so they bested Tony Blair's party, too. And his operatives and the Labour Party operatives said, you know, it's Iraq. That's the reason why we've gotten such a dismal showing. And they're absolutely right. It is the war in Iraq. And people turned out and supported the Conservatives. And the reason the Liberal Democrats beat the Labour Party for in this historic upset is because the Liberal Democrats came out against the war.
Yeah, and not only did Liberal Democrats come out against the war, but you have the Labour Party, which is historically the party that is critical of the military, critical of foreign interventionism in Britain. The base of the Labour Party is the group that is most upset by Tony Blair's actions, going against the wishes of his constituency and going hand in hand with George Bush in the war in Iraq. And so they were the ones who moved to the Liberal Democrats. They were the ones who moved what has historically been a third place party into being the official opposition in these by districts.
All right.
Yeah, this is a bad showing for Blair, because his general elections are going to be next year, and if this continues, his party's going to be out of power.
And not only out of power, but not even in the official opposition. I mean, you're talking about historic to the level of, if this were extrapolated over over a full election, you could have a party that goes from having been in power for nearly a decade to being an afterthought in British politics.
Yeah, which is a historic first in British politics, at least in the last 100 years.
All right. Well, speaking of Iraq, that takes us to This Week in Iraq.
This Week in Iraq.
I want to talk first about this worsening security situation. Now, the Bush administration is trying to make it look like security is getting better, but it is really worsening dramatically. In Najaf and Kufa, UF's troops pulled back from the center of the two cities, and that has allowed al-Sadr's militia to remain in control and to keep their guns. Now, if folks might remember, George Bush had bragged that U.S. troops were disarming illegal militias. That is clearly not the case. By Wednesday, the al-Mahdi army, that's al-Sadr's militia, was attacking Iraqi police in Najaf, and they had looted a police station on Friday. Now, U.S. troops, who in the previous couple of weeks were quick to shoot at anybody who was carrying a gun in Najaf, just kind of sat and didn't do anything while this was happening. And you'd have to ask, as I did, why the dramatic change? And I believe it's because of political reasons. Now, the Bush administration, the Bush campaign folks, and civilians in his administration are really leaning hard on the Pentagon to make it seem like the security situation is improving and that Iraqi police are taking care of the problem. But that is simply not true. 95% of Najaf's police force deserted in April when the al-Mahdi army took over the city of Najaf. And now the new Najaf police are made up primarily of raw recruits who have had no training. They have little or nothing in the way of uniforms, and only half of them have guns.
Yeah, not only did all these folks desert in April when the militia took over, but they also took all the supplies with them.
That's right. So the al-Mahdi
army... And all the weaponry, too.
Yes, now the al-Mahdi army has the guns that were meant for the Iraqi police. Meanwhile, in Fallujah, according to the Washington Post, who actually sent a reporter outside of Baghdad to try to get into Fallujah, and it's a hair-raising story to read about, the new Fallujah Brigade only controls a few checkpoints on the outskirts of the city. Now, this is the brigade that the U.S. Marines set up, supposedly, to police Fallujah. These are the guys who are supposedly former Saddam Hussein folks who are supposed to go in there and be the new official legal militia to run the city of Fallujah. Those guys are cowering in their tents on the outskirts of the city. They control a few checkpoints. In the meantime, the insurgents control the bulk of the city. Now, this week, the insurgents decided that they were going to attack the Fallujah Brigade for the first time. They fired a few mortars at their tents, and I guarantee you there's going to be more of that in the future. Now, the U.S. general who's been in charge of training the Iraqi police, the guy who's been supposedly training the new police recruits to take over the security situation in Iraq, he said this week that the whole training program that he's been overseeing for the past year has been an absolute flop. Army Major General Paul Eaton told the Associated Press, quote, "It hasn't gone well. We've had almost 1 year of no progress." And that tells you where... how close we're getting to the Iraqis actually taking over and policing their own country. Now, in the meantime, sabotage has been continuing on Iraq's infrastructure. Now, if you really want to win the hearts and minds of the Iraqi people, this is what analysts have been saying over and over and over again, you got to get the electricity going, you got to get the water flowing, you got to get the sewage out of the streets, you got to get things up and running. Now, this week, two major oil pipelines were bombed. The line from Kirkuk to Turkey, that stopped exports out of the northern oil fields yet again. And the line from the Baiji refinery to Baghdad, which cut off power to the capital city. Now, a new Iraqi government employee of the new interim government released a report to the New York Times that shows that more than 100 power lines have been cut and over 1,200 electrical towers have been toppled by saboteurs since the invasion started over a year ago. But these numbers only count the attacks through March because the report is issued on a quarterly basis. There were some 68 separate incidents of sabotage to the electrical grid in January through March, and everyone in that ministry pretty much agrees that there's been a large increase in those attacks over the last 2 to 3 months. Now,
yeah. Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Baghdad and the rest of Iraq has electricity for about 8 hours a day, but that doesn't come in one chunk. It comes in increments of about 2 hours at a time. Now, this is less than half of the pre-war levels. So folks in Baghdad are scratching their heads and saying, we had double the amount of electricity when Saddam was in power. What's the matter with this picture?
Yeah, that's exactly what I was about to talk about, was that not only was it less than half of when Saddam was in power, but when Saddam was in power under U.S. sanctions as one of the poorest regimes on the face of the earth.
Unable to get replacement parts.
Unable to get replacement parts. And now you have the richest, most powerful country in the world running Iraq, and they can't offer basic services. They can't get the sewage out of the streets. They can't supply electricity. They can't do any of these things, and they cannot supply basic security either.
And this is a bad time of the year for this to be happening, because temperatures are currently above 100 degrees in Baghdad.
And rising.
And summer temperatures are expected to get up over 120. So with no air conditioning, no fans, no refrigeration, things are going to get pretty wild this summer with riots in the streets, I think.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Now here in the U.S., some things have been happening. The U.S. and Britain made two final changes to the draft resolution that they had proposed to the U.N. for the U.N. Security Council to approve the U.S., the new interim government and the U.S. control of Iraq. The resolution finally passed the Security Council unanimously, and that resolution gives U.N. sanction to the U.S. hand-picked interim government. And this interim government is going to have control of Iraqi oil money, the ability to rack up more debt for Iraq. It'll have control of the Iraqi security forces, such as they are. And unfortunately for them, they'll have to control the security situation, too. Now, on June 30th, the Coalition Provisional Authority will dissolve, and U.S. forces will officially become a, quote, U.S.-led U.N. peacekeeping force. And that is pretty much in name only. Yeah, that's pretty much in name only, since nobody on the U.N. Security Council stepped forward to pledge more troops. And also this week, NATO pretty much nixed any possibility of sending any NATO troops to help in Iraq.
Yeah, now, this moves us into a situation very reminiscent of what we had in South Vietnam, where you had a government that was being propped up by the United States that had no constituency of its own and very little outside legitimacy, but was used as kind of a fig leaf to cover up the fact that the United States was running the show.
Yeah, and in this case, the UN is now being added as a second fig leaf here. Now, speaking of that U.S. propped up government, the head of the interim government, Ayed Alawi, is so out of touch with the Iraqi people that he openly bragged about his ties to the CIA and 15 other intelligence agencies around the world, even though he didn't actually name those intelligence agencies. Now, a former CIA officer who was based in the Middle East told the New York Times that Dr. Alawi's group used CIA funds, that's U.S. taxpayer money, to set off car bombs in Baghdad during the early 1990s. One of these bombs blew apart a school bus, killing Iraqi school children. Now, when I read this, it was one of those oh my God moments where I kind of realized that the Bush administration is so unable to see the forest for the trees, that they would put a man in power in Iraq who is a former car bomber and terrorist. It sort of seems to me that the Bush administration's motto is fight terrorism with terrorism, something that is only going to lead to more terrorism.
And see, when I saw the quote about the 15 different intelligence agencies, I had a different oh my God moment.
Well, I'm not talking about the 15 different intelligence agencies. I'm talking about the fact
that you are.
Alawi was in charge of a CIA program to send car bombs into Baghdad.
No, I understand that. I'm talking about a different oh my God moment entirely.
Oh, okay.
Entirely.
Okay.
I mean, and this is the hallmark of the Bush administration, is that it generates so many of these.
Uh-huh.
But my oh my God moment with all these is, if you're talking about 15 different intelligence agencies, most of them are Western. Most of them probably have ties to the Middle East. What are you talking about? You're talking about Mossad. You're talking about a man who collaborated with the Israelis. And how is that going to go over? among ordinary Iraqis.
Yeah.
That here is a man who almost certainly had ties to helping to oppress the Palestinians.
Yeah, and so we saw a huge upsurge in car bombings and other attacks this week in Iraq, including the assassination just yesterday, or just last night and early this morning, of one of the leading diplomats in the Foreign Office there in Iraq, a guy who probably had the most experience of anybody in his new department. He was assassinated in a drive-by shooting this morning.
All right, we got about 4 minutes left, and we got a couple of events to plug. But I'm just wondering, Maria, can you briefly just tell us about the terrorist attacks worldwide that are picking up?
Yeah, let's just talk about that briefly.
and just a cheerful little goodbye for the week. Right?
Yeah, no, it's interesting that the U.S. Administration keeps talking about how, you know, it's these foreign terrorists in Iraq who are running all these attacks. And I think I mentioned last week the UN envoy, Lakhdar Brahimi, saying that, no, these insurgents in Iraq are likely not foreign terrorists. They're almost certainly Iraqi patriots, was the term he used. Iraqi patriots who are concerned that their country is being occupied by a foreign power and that the U.S. ought to negotiate with them. In the meantime, there have been a number of terrorist attacks in other parts of the world, including in Saudi Arabia, that we haven't talked much about here on Eat the Airwaves. Saudi Arabia has seen some very direct terrorist attacks against Western oil companies in their country, and the same has happened this week in Pakistan. A high up general in Pakistan was the target of an assassination attempt. And then there's news that in Indonesia, the group there that Jamaah Islamiyah, the group there that was that the government thinks was responsible for the Bali bombings, is planning assassination attempts in Indonesia. So clearly what's going on is, while the U.S. is tied up with the war in Iraq, fighting Iraqi patriots, terrorism is actually going up around the world and is pretty much marching on. Al-Qaeda is pursuing their agenda everywhere else but Iraq.
In the war on terror, terror is winning.
Mm-hmm. Or as the market model would say, they're franchising.
Yeah.
So, all right. Well, with that, we're coming close to be out of time. But event to plug, something happening tonight.
Yeah, called Weapons of Mass Distraction. This is a multimedia event that's going to be happening in the Segway over in Ballard, the old Safeway building there.
For folks who don't have the address, because it wasn't on all of the flyers that were put out for this event, the address is 5710 22nd Avenue Northwest.
Yeah.
It's the old Safeway building.
Yeah, and Mike and I will both be there speaking, and a lot of proceeds from this are going to Eat the State. We are still continuing the pledge drive for Eat the State. We need money to keep printing. We have a huge printer debt that we need to retire, and beyond that, ongoing expenses. So people can go to the website at www.eatthestate.org. You can donate directly over there. You can send checks to P.O. Box 85541, Seattle, Washington 98145. And if you value alternative information like this, stuff you're not getting out of the Seattle Times, you're not getting out of the evening news, certainly, you know, we need your help to keep putting this out. It's simple as that.
Yeah, or you can come to the Weapons of Mass Distraction tonight, hear some good music, hear a little good political discussion.
Yeah,
and
starts at 8 p.m.
It's a benefit for alternative media, and we're one of the beneficiaries. And again, that's at 5710 22nd Avenue Northwest at the old Safeway in Ballard. Starts at 9 p.m.
Yeah.
And people should know that the donations they give are go through an all-volunteer effort, that you know, you guys aren't pulling in any...
No, we don't get paid
figure.
For this.
No. All we do is lose sleep on Saturday mornings and Friday nights, actually.
Well, it's only fair because a lot of the info you give out causes others to lose sleep. So,
yeah,
you
know, well,
it comes full circle. So.